Okay, it's birthday time here on Iris, and it's February 13th, 2024, and we have one birthday we're celebrating today, and that is Douglas Noland of Iowa City. So, Douglas, a very happy birthday to you on this February 13th. You're listening to Iris on Iowa, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you're not a registered Iris user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. Now we'll turn to today's obituaries with Deanna.
Thank you, Pat. James P. Messler of West Burlington, age 88, died Sunday, February 11th in West Burlington. Born June 29th, 1935 in Omaha, he was the son of Paul and Irma Toyson Messler. On August 9th, 1958, he married Monica Meyer at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Burlington. She died on July 20th of 2022. James was a 1953 graduate of Burlington Catholic High School and a 1955 graduate of Burlington Junior College. He served in the U.S. Navy Reserves from 1953 until 1961. Jim worked at CB&Q Railroad Shops as an electrician, Carson Pierre Scott as an assistant manager, Drake Hardware Company as a buyer, and was co-owner of Messler Supply and Fur Company with his wife for over 40 years. He was a member of Divine Mercy Parish, Knights of Columbus, number 568, Mackin Assembly, 4th degree, number 261, and board member of St. Mary's Catholic Cemetery. He was the co-founder and lifetime member of the Iowa Trappers Association, inducted into the Iowa Trappers Hall of Fame in 2002, and a lifetime member of National Trapping Association. Jim volunteered with the Des Moines County Sheriff's Department as a reserve officer for 14 years and the West Burlington Police Department as a reserve officer for 2 years. Survivors include his four children, Anne Marie Kirk of Burlington, Jean Elizabeth, married to Leon Helling of Ankeny, Iowa, Thomas James, married to Deborah Messler, of Windham Summit, Pennsylvania, and Patrick Joseph, married to Anne of Burlington. Nine great-grandchildren, and several nieces and nephews. Besides his wife, he was preceded in death by his parents. A photo tribute can be viewed and condolences can be sent to the family by visiting James's obituary at prugfuneral.com. Ruth Louise Sage, age 88, of Beatrice, passed away Sunday, February 11th. She was born on February 16th in 1935 in Des Moines. Survivors include her two sons, Stephen, married to Adam Black of Toronto, Canada, and Bradley of Sprague, Nebraska. Five grandchildren. She was preceded in death by her husband, Jim, in 2016. Funeral services will be at 2:30 p.m. on Thursday, February 15th at Fox Funeral Home of Beatrice. Burial will be at the Evergreen Home Cemetery of Beatrice. Arrangements are entrusted to Fox Funeral Home and Cremation Services. Peter Coleman, known as Pete, age 84 of Urbandale, met Christ's Peace on February 9th at the Des Moines Veterans CLC Hospice after fighting late diagnosis lung cancer. A memorial service will be held on Saturday, February 17th at 11 o'clock in the morning at the Ankeny Funeral Home and Crematory, located at 1510 West 1st Street in Ankeny. Visitation will be held 1 hour before the service at the funeral home. A military interment ceremony will take place at Iowa Veterans Cemetery in Van Meter at a future date to be announced. Pete is survived by his wife of 61 years, Patricia, daughters Tamara, married to Jim Foreman of Ankeny, and Kimberly, married to Dan Callahan of Grimes. Grandchildren Coleman and James Foreman and Kylie and Sierra Callahan, his sister Ruby Weinman of Mason City, and dozens of nieces and nephews. And there's a poem on today's obituary page written by James Stewart. Each life is a song. A life is like a song we write in our own tone and key. Each life we touch reflects a note that forms the melody. We choose the theme and chorus of the song to bear our name, and each will have a special sound. No two can be the same. So when someone we love departs, in memory we find their song plays on within the hearts of those they leave behind. Pat, back to you.
Thank you, Deanna. Continuing now with world and national news, Israeli raid frees two hostages in Rafah. Airstrikes providing cover for the operation kill scores of Palestinians. John Bacon of USA Today wrote this article. Israeli security forces stormed an apartment in the heart of Rafah on Monday, freeing two hostages and killing their three militant guards in an operation that Gaza officials say cost scores of Palestinian lives. Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, spokesperson for the Israeli military, said Fernando Simon Marmon and Louis Har were in good condition at Sheba Tal Hashmer Medical Center near Tel Aviv. Har's son-in-law, Aydin Begeno, visited with the released captives and said they were thin and pale but aware of their surroundings. Video from the scene shows the joyous men wearing sweatsuits, holding long, tearful embraces with their relatives. Hagari said, "Last night we brought Louis and Fernando back home. This was a complex operation under fire in the heart of Rafah based on very sensitive and high-quality intelligence." The strike team breached the apartment shortly before 2 a.m., killed the guards, and hugged and protected Louis and Fernando with their bodies, Hagari said. The rescue drew militant fire from nearby buildings and intense firepower from the air was required, he said. Airstrikes that provided cover for the operation killed at least 67 Palestinians, Health Ministry spokesman Ashraf Kidra said. Israel has pressed its invasion of Gaza into Rafah over the objections of neighboring Egypt, the United States, UN, and most global leaders who fear for more than 1 million Palestinians who fled to Rafah from fighting farther north. Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said the rescue operation was a turning point in the war. Gallant spoke to members of the elite Israeli Yamin police unit, which led the raid that freed the hostages. "Hamas is vulnerable and penetrable," he said in translation by the Times of Israel. He added, "We still have hostages and we need to reach them," adding that hopefully most will be freed through a peace deal, but how many more times will rescue be required and under what circumstances, who knows. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu lauded the daring action of the rescue team and stressed his recurring theme that only continued military pressure will free the hostages. "We will not miss any opportunities to bring them home." Marmon, who's 60 years old, and Har, who's 70, had been seized from near Yishak, a kibbutz on the Gaza border, during the October 7th attack by Hamas-backed militants. More than 1,200 people were killed and over 240 were kidnapped and brought to Gaza in the attack that lasted a few hours. The subsequent Israeli military assault on Gaza has killed more than 28,000 Palestinians, the Gaza Health Ministry says. Israel says 10,000 of them were militants and blames the civilian deaths on Hamas for using them as human shields. More than 12,300 Palestinian children and young teens have been killed since the war began, the health ministry said on Monday. Israel says about 100 hostages remain in Hamas captivity and that the effort to rescue them remains a priority. The release of Har and Marmon reunites them with three other abducted family members returned to Israel as part of the hostage release during a week-long ceasefire in November. They are Clara Marmon, age 63, her sister, Gabriella Leinberg, age 59, and Gabriella's daughter, Mia, age 17, who was taken and freed with her dog, Bella. All five were seized from a safe room at a family member's home in the kibbutz. Al-Kidra said rescuers were still searching rubble for more victims of the airstrikes. An Associated Press journalist counted at least 50 bodies that were taken to Abu Yusuf al-Najjar Hospital in Rafah. Resident Mohammed Zagrob said he saw a black jeep speeding near the Shabara refugee camp just before the airstrikes enveloped his neighborhood. He told the AP, "We found ourselves running with our children from the airstrikes in every direction." A young man carried the body of an infant who he said was killed in the attacks. He said the girl, the daughter of his neighbor, was born and killed during the war, let Netanyahu come and see. Is this one of your designated targets? He said. A senior Biden administration official told the Associated Press on condition of anonymity that a ceasefire framework is mostly in place, but Hamas's Al-Aqsa television station cited an official for the militant group saying invading Rafah would scuttle the talks. In addition, the AP reported two Egyptian officials and a Western diplomat said Egypt threatened to suspend the Camp David Accords of the late 1970s if Israel sent troops into Rafah, which could cause waves of trapped Palestinians to try to flee into Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte in the Middle East for meetings Monday with Israel and Palestinian officials joined a cavalcade of world leaders urging Israel to curtail its military mission in Gaza. Rutte listed three priorities: a massive increase in humanitarian aid for Gaza, release of all hostages, and a significant reduction in the intensity of Israeli military operations in Gaza. Rutte said a large-scale military operation in Rafah would have catastrophic humanitarian consequences. All this calls for an immediate pause in fighting, which must culminate in a lasting end to this conflict, Rutte said, adding that the sustainable political solution is a viable Palestinian state next to a safe Israel. Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. On page 3 of the main section, details emerge in Texas megachurch shooting. This is from Christopher Kahn and Dinah Voiles Pulver of USA Today. Texas police on Monday identified the alleged assailant who was killed by police in a shooting at Joel Osteen's megachurch that left a 7-year-old in critical condition and another person injured as 36-year-old Janice Marino. At approximately 1:53 p.m. local time Sunday, Marino walked into Lakewood Church wearing a trench coat and a backpack and opened fire, said Houston Police Department Homicide Division Commander Chris Hassig at a press briefing on Monday. She was accompanied by a young child who Hassig said arrived in the back seat of her vehicle. A pair of off-duty officers at the church fatally shot Marino during an exchange of fire, Finner said. She was confirmed dead at the scene. During the incident, the 7-year-old boy was shot in the head and later rushed to Texas Children's Hospital by Houston Fire Department personnel. It's unclear who shot the child. Houston Police Chief Troy Finner said, "What we need to do for him is pray." A 57-year-old man was also struck by gunfire. Police said he was released from the hospital. Authorities have not released a motive for the shooting. Janice Yvonne Marino, age 36, had used aliases, including Jeffrey Escalante, Hassig said. Police said documents and police interviews identified Marino as a woman. Marino has arrests dating back to 2005, according to a Texas Department of Public Safety criminal history search. Most recently, Marino was arrested in April of 2022 on a charge of unlawfully carrying a weapon, according to the Fort Bend County Court website. Marino pleaded guilty to the misdemeanor in October of the same year. Marino, who is from El Salvador, worked in real estate, according to a LinkedIn page. The gunfire rang out just before a Spanish language service was set to start at the 16,000-seat venue, which formerly served as a sports arena. Videos from inside the building showed a frenzy, with many churchgoers running from the exits, while others lay on the floor and took cover beneath their seats. Both off-duty officers had been placed on administrative duty pending the outcome of an internal investigation, said Finner. At the time of the shooting, one officer, aged 38, with 4 years of service, worked as an agent for the Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission. The other, aged 28, with 2 years of service, worked for the Houston Police Department. Joel Osteen, one of the highest-profile pastors in the country who presides over services attended by tens of thousands, said the shooting has left him in a fog. He said, "We've been here 65 years, and to have somebody shooting in our church," Austin said at a news briefing with police, "we don't understand why this happened. We're going to pray for that little boy and pray for the lady that was deceased and her family and all, and the other gentleman that was released from the hospital." Pat, back to you.
Thank you, Deanna. A couple of shorter stories on page 5A. A storm is expected to dump snow across the Northeast. A fast-moving storm pushing through the eastern half of the country could bring major disruption to travel in the Northeast through Tuesday. Widespread heavy snowfall was expected across northern Pennsylvania and southern New York late Monday, then in southern New England Tuesday morning, the Weather Prediction Center said late Sunday. Boston is the biggest city in the path of the storm, forecasters said, with up to a foot of snow possible. Schools in Boston are closed today. New York City also had a chance of getting significant impact, said David Roth, a meteorologist with the Weather Prediction Center in College Park, Maryland. The probability of more than 8 inches of snow ranged from 70% to 90% along a swath of Pennsylvania-New York border and across most of Massachusetts, according to the Weather Prediction Center. Winter storm advisories and warnings went into effect across Oklahoma, northern Arkansas, southern Missouri, and northern Kentucky. Across areas across parts of the southern Appalachians and the southern Mid-Atlantic faced a risk of excessive rainfall over Monday and into Tuesday, with a chance for local flash flooding as the system moved through. An intensifying nor'easter along the coast was forecast to cause moderate coastal flooding at high tide along the Jersey Shore and portions of the New England coast. Onshore winds could push the ocean up into island or inland rivers and increase the chances for some coastal flooding, Ross said. The region has already seen at least 2 big coastal flood events this winter, as well as higher than normal tides over the weekend. Fortunately, the system will move quickly, reducing the risk, Ross said. This doesn't have the hallmarks of a record event. The storms will bring enhanced rainfall because there's a lot of moisture aloft flowing up over Mexico and moisture moving into the region from the Gulf of Mexico, Ross said. You're getting moisture from both oceans at multiple levels, and that's why we're experiencing some flash flooding. And from the Super Bowl commercials, Twins Reunion voted the top Super Bowl commercial. Patrick Mahomes and Travis Kelce appeared in a State Farm insurance ad earlier in these NFL playoffs, but they were busy Sunday night. So State Farm opted for another set of twins and ended up winning the hearts of Super Bowl viewers. Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito, first paired in a 1988 box office smash, were reunited for State Farm's Super Bowl entry and walked off with the top spot in USA Today's 36th ad meter contest. The 60-second spot features Schwarzenegger playing a State Farm employee in an action film, rescuing puppies and a pregnant woman from a burning home. Yet the Austrian-born bodybuilder, actor, and former California governor struggles to pronounce the insurance giant's tagline, giving his pal DeVito an opening to save the day in a surprise cameo. Like a Good Neighbor scored 6.68, outpointing Duncan's 6.52. The Coffee Giants ad once again teamed actor Ben Affleck and wife Jennifer Lopez, joined by Affleck's Boston brothers Tom Brady and Matt Damon. In a commercial lineup dotted by megastars, most notably Beyoncé, whose Verizon spot dovetailed with the release of 2 new songs off a forthcoming album, it was Schwarzenegger, age 76, who carried the day. The Terminator, Predator, and Kindergarten Cop star remains popular across generations. He has 26 million Instagram followers, nearly double Mahomes and Kelce combined, and revived his action star iconography, I'm sorry, for this spot. I'm always there for him, DeVito, 79, told USA Today. He's always there for me. We have a great relationship. 1 year after a rookie entry, the farmer's dog captured the ad meter crown. State Farm returned the title to a legacy advertiser. Duncan was followed in the top 5 by Kia, Uber Eats, and the NFL, which, like Duncan, recorded a second consecutive top 5 finish. It was a rougher second year for the Jesus-touting He Gets Us foot-washing finished 44th out of 59 rated ads, while Who Is My Neighbor finished 55th, a spot for Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s presidential bid, which replays a jingle from his Uncle John Kennedy's campaign in 1960, finished last. Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. 2 shorter stories from page 7. Trump asks for delay in election interference case. This is from Maureen Gropp of USA Today, Dateline Washington. Former President Donald Trump on Monday asked the Supreme Court to continue to delay a criminal trial into whether he tried to overturn the 2020 election while he appeals a lower court's ruling that he is not immune from prosecution. Trump's lawyers told the court, without immunity from criminal prosecution, the presidency as we know it will cease to exist. Trump's lawyers urged the high court to postpone the trial while his appeal is heard at the full District of Columbia, the D.C. Circuit, and then, if necessary, before the Supreme Court. Trump has pleaded not guilty to four federal charges in the case before U.S. District Court Judge Tanya Shutkin, three for conspiracy and one for obstruction, for falsely claiming election fraud and trying to overturn the legitimate election results. While former presidents have broad immunity from civil lawsuits for official actions taken while serving in the White House, Trump has attempted to claim sweeping immunity from criminal prosecution. Trump's lawyer, John Sauer, argued that a president should be shielded from criminal charges for his actions while in office, even after his term is ended, because otherwise political rivals could seek to punish him for contentious policy decisions. A three-judge panel of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals unanimously ruled February 6th that Trump can be tried for allegedly trying to steal the 2020 election. Experts described the 57-page opinion as a resounding rejection of Trump's claim of absolute immunity. It says, for the purpose of this criminal case, former President Trump has become Citizen Trump with all the defenses of any other criminal defendant, the panel wrote. Any executive immunity that may have protected him while he served as president no longer protects him against this prosecution. Shutkin had scheduled Trump's trial for March 4th, but she put proceedings on hold in December while the immunity issue was being appealed. Trump has sought to push this and three other criminal trials he faces until after the November election. Four justices must agree in order to hear that case. It would take five of the nine justices to keep the trial on hold while Trump appeals. There are several possibilities as to what happens next. The fastest resolution would be if the Supreme Court leaves the appeals court's decision standing and allows trial preparations to resume. In that case, the trial could start in a few months. The longest would be if it agrees to postpone the trial and gives Trump the full time available to file his appeal. Under that scenario, Trump would likely not be tried until after the November election. The court could also keep the trial on hold but fast-track the appeals process. That could allow for enough time for a trial verdict before the November election if the High Court agrees with the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. The justices haven't always supported Trump in past cases, despite his having appointed three of them. And then an article from USA Today's Marina Potofsky and David Jackson, entitled NATO Leader Says Trump's Threats Put Troops at Risk. NATO's Secretary General issued a warning to leaders around the world after former President Donald Trump stirred fears about the future of the organization. At a South Carolina rally, Trump criticized countries in the international alliance that have not met certain goals. NATO members are asked to spend at least 2% of their gross domestic product on defense. The former president has often targeted nations that haven't reached that bar, but on Saturday, Trump specifically recalled a conversation he claims he had when he was in office. As per Trump's recollection, one of the presidents of a big country stood up and said, "Well, sir, if we don't pay and we're attacked by Russia, will you protect us?" Trump claimed that he responded, "No, I would not protect you. In fact, I would encourage them to do whatever the blank they want." NATO's charter requires members to come to the aid of others if they are attacked. The former president's comments immediately drew backlash. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said in a statement Sunday that Trump's remarks could endanger both civilians and troops. Stoltenberg said, "Any suggestion that allies will not defend each other undermines all of our security, including that of the U.S., and puts American and European soldiers at increased risk. I expect that regardless of who wins the presidential election, the U.S. will remain a strong and committed NATO ally." In a statement released by President Joe Biden's re-election committee campaign, Biden said, "If my opponent, Donald Trump, is able to regain power, He is making it clear as day that he will abandon our NATO allies if Russia attacks and allow Russia to do whatever the blank they want with him. Former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, who is running against Trump for the 2024 GOP presidential nomination, said Sunday that NATO had been a success story for the last 75 years. She said, "Now we do want NATO allies to pull their weight, but there are ways you can do that without sitting there and telling Russia to have your way with these countries." Pat.
Thank you, Deanna. Virginia aims to bolster its mental health care initiative as part of a national focus after the pandemic. This is a story by Sarah Rankin, Associated Press. John Clare, the police chief of a small Appalachian town in southwest Virginia, spends his days consumed by a growing problem: the frequency with which his officers are tapped to detain, transport, and wait in hospitals with people in the throes of a mental health crisis. Officers from Clare's 21-member Marion Police Department crisscross the state to deliver patients for court-ordered treatment, sometimes only discover the hospital where they were sent has no available beds. Patients end up boarding in waiting rooms or emergency rooms, sometimes for days on end, while under the supervision of Clare's officers. It is a problem for law enforcement agencies around Virginia, one that advocates, attorneys, and leaders like Clare say ties up policing resources and contributes to poor patient outcomes. In the past 5 years, these types of transports have become the largest single category of case the Marion Department handles. "We're against the wall," said Clare, an Army veteran and former lay pastor who sometimes shuttles patients himself, and did so last month on a nearly 15-hour round trip to a coastal city on the other side of the state. "The problem underscores a widely held consensus that Virginia's mental health care system is in urgent need of reform due to what Governor Glenn Youngkin's administration says is an over-reliance on hospitalization at a time of growing need." About a year ago, Youngkin, a Republican, rolled out an ambitious initiative that aims to transform the way psychiatric care is delivered by creating a system that allows people to get the treatment they need without delay in their own community and not necessarily in the confines of a hospital, easing the burden on both patients and law enforcement. While Virginia's struggles may be particularly acute, Youngkin is not alone in his focus on the issue. "Improving mental health care became a priority in the United States like never before as the pandemic brought new levels of isolation, fear, and grief, in addition to pre-existing crises such as rising drug overdose deaths and the struggles burdening teen girls." Survey data from the U.S. Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration found that in 2022, about half of adults with any mental illness did not receive treatment. "We know that there's a lot of partisan divide across the country, but what we found is whether it's red states or blue states, there's a lot of support for behavioral health at this point," said Brian Hepburn, executive director of the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors. Youngkin's emphasis on mental health developed during his 2021 campaign when person after person, from doctor to local officials to police, pleaded with him to make it a priority, according to John Littell, the cabinet secretary overseeing the Virginia initiative. Littell said it was just so clear that people were really struggling. Youngkin has since won bipartisan support for his Right Help, Right Now initiative and praise from advocates, though some worry about the pace at which things are moving. The governor, whose press office says the initiative is exceeding key milestones, cannot seek a second consecutive term and leaves office in 2 years. The initiative's wide-ranging goals include building up the behavioral health care workforce and working to stem the tide of overdose deaths, which claim the lives of an average of 7 Virginians a day in 2022. Youngkin has signed dozens of related bills into law and has secured hundreds of millions in new funding, with more proposed. Well, for the last 90 minutes, readers have been Deanna Snyder and Pat Steele. It's been our pleasure to read for you. Now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers, Dale and Doug, to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Dale Finnegan and Doug Kretzinger. We'll continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. And here is Doug with our next article.
And somebody tell Biden 2024 election is here, is the headline to this opinion written by Sarah Pequeno. And she is election columnist on X, formerly Twitter. That's who she is. And this is what she wrote. Republicans are in full primary mode. Everywhere you turn, there's headlines about Donald Trump's political resurrection and Nikki Haley's floundering campaign, including her embarrassing loss to none of these candidates in Nevada. It's hard to escape their nomination process. Meanwhile, President Joe Biden and his campaign staff seem to be ignoring that there's a presidential election at the end of the year, and his opponent is already riling up his base. Biden told Variety that he wouldn't be interviewed during the Super Bowl pregame show, as previous presidents have done. It would have been his best opportunity to make a case for his reelection in front of the nation, but he chose to skip the questions altogether for the second year in a row. It's a huge miscalculation and one of Biden's many missed opportunities to spread his message. We are 9 months away from the presidential election, and Biden needs to boost his standing with voters. A recent NBC News poll found his approval rating hovering at 37%. It's time for him to start acting like there's an election to care about, and he must stop allowing his messaging to be muddled by Congress's shenanigans and the country's involvement in foreign affairs. He's already got two winning topics to campaign on. Biden can win by focusing on abortion rights. Abortion rights should be the easiest rallying cry for Biden. 52% of U.S. adults believe abortion is morally acceptable, and recent elections show that. Six states have voted on abortion-related constitutional amendments since Roe v. Wade was overturned in 2022. The abortion rights side triumphed in every election, even though three of those states, Kansas, Kentucky, and Ohio, went for Trump in 2020. Expect more states to test strict abortion measures as we continue in 2024. You would think that Biden would use the outrage people so clearly feel to his advantage. It is a topic that ignites the base of the Democratic Party and is one of the few places he could actually win over Republican women. Yet, it's an issue he never seems to address with the fervor it deserves. The president started to tackle the topic in January, saying he would sign any federal legislation that would codify Roe. But the reality is that said legislation will not come to fruition unless the Democrats sweep Congress in the upcoming election and win a supermajority in the Senate. Biden has said previously that he isn't big on abortion, but it is an easy win for Democrats. It's an issue that has consistently turned out voters and will continue to be in the upcoming year. He must move beyond the White House news release and hiding behind Vice President Kamala Harris, who has become the face of the issue for the administration. A greater step would be visiting abortion battleground states and speaking with health care providers there. The Democratic Party needs to show voters who are most affected by the loss of abortion access that they are exhausting every avenue to ensure that this right is reinstated. While Biden's campaign could be doing more to tout abortion rights, he also needs to counteract Trump's messaging that the economy is doing bad. The NBC News poll found that 55% of voters think Trump would do a better job of dealing with the economy, compared with the 33% who feel that way about Biden. Truthfully, there's little the president can actually do to control the economy. It's up to the attitudes of consumers and how businesses respond to those attitudes. Despite this, the health of the economy sways voters every election. Biden may as well use it to his advantage, especially because the economy is doing well. 4 points. Number one, the unemployment rate is holding at 3.7% and has stayed until under 4% for the past 2 years. And number two, there were 353,000 jobs added to the market in January after a surprising 2.7 million jobs were added last year. Number three, inflation fell to 3.4% in December since reaching a 40-year high of 9.1% in June of 2022. And finally, number four, the country has seen an increase in average hourly wages. Biden and his supporters need to be touting this at every opportunity if they want to change the narrative ahead of November. He needs to keep visiting working-class people to hear how price increases are affecting them. But he should also be reminding the greater public that things are actually improving post-COVID, at least for now. Simply put, Biden must begin treating 2024 like an election year instead of shying away from opportunities like the Super Bowl interview. The Democratic Party must remind people what this election will be and do more than just be not Trump. If Biden wants to ensure people in his base show up to vote, he needs to remind us exactly what he's accomplished, what his plan for the next 4 years is, and what is at stake in this election.
The second opinion from the USA Today is titled, "Why Did Border Security Bill Fail? Blame Trump." And this opinion is written by Senator Martin Heinrich. He says, "New Mexico has a front row seat to our country's broken immigration system. Every day, we see the real life consequences of that broken system on families and communities. The solutions aren't easy, but they also are as clear as day. We need to tackle the huge backlog for lawful immigration so it doesn't take years for a person's paperwork to be processed. And we need to invest in smart border security technology that better detects and stops drugs like fentanyl before they get into our communities. We need to better staff and support the law enforcement agencies at our border that are helping to maintain our national security and efficiently process cross-border trade with our largest trade partner, Mexico. We need more pathways for skilled immigrants eager to fill labor shortages in industries with severe workforce shortages, like agriculture and healthcare. And we need to finally ensure that Dreamers have a swift path to full citizenship after being brought here illegally as kids. But Congress has failed over and over to deliver these solutions. Time and again, I have heard my Republican colleagues claim that they want to, quote, secure the border, end quote. Last week was their opportunity to prove that they meant it. Once again, they failed to deliver. The Senate voted on a historic bipartisan national security, border security, and immigration reform legislation that was the result of many months of bipartisan negotiations. I voted to support this bill because I, like most New Mexicans, am done with our badly broken system. Nearly all of my Republican colleagues voted no to even starting debate on the bill. While no compromise is ever perfect, this bill would have made our asylum process faster, delivering safety to those who legitimately need it. It also invested in smart border security to cut down on drug trafficking and unauthorized crossings at our southern border. Before even seeing what was in the bill, House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, declared that it would be, quote, dead on arrival, end quote, in the House. Almost all Republican senators followed suit and chose political showmanship over leadership. Republican Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa told reporters, in quotes, "I am very disappointed that so many of our members came out as a hard no before the legislation was even released," end quote. Why did Republicans jump to oppose a bill that would deliver exactly what they claimed to want? Because former President Donald Trump told them to. Improving border security apparently wasn't ever a real factor in their decision-making. Trump recently told his supporters to, quote, please blame it on me, end quote, if Republicans in Congress blocked a border security legislation. That's because, in Trump's view, chaos at the border helps him politically. In New Mexico, when something is broken, you don't just go around complaining. You get to work and fix it. Republicans are doing the opposite. They're more interested in preserving their political talking points than improving border security. Americans deserve better. We deserve decisions driven by what's good for our country and communities, not what's good for Trump's campaign rallies. As the son of an immigrant, I know the hope that our nation represents for so many people seeking to build a better life. We need to get to work fixing our immigration system so it can deliver on our foundational values. And we need border security that keeps our communities safe. We deserve elected leaders courageous enough to get it done. And again, that opinion was written by Senator Martin Heinrich, who is a Democrat representing New Mexico.
And it's time to go to sports on the Des Moines Register. Here's a story written by Randy Peterson. Iowa State's place in the new world of college basketball. Dateline is Ames. Pass things first. Before plunging ahead to number 10, Iowa State's 6 p.m. Tuesday men's basketball game at Big 12 newcomer Cincinnati. 7 times after the Cyclones' victory against TCU on Saturday, Horned Frogs coach Jamie Dixon used the phrase, new world. His words repetition started when asked about Iowa State's quick turnaround under T.J. Otzelberger and his staff after inheriting a program that was coming off the worst record in school history. Otzelberger has led the Cyclones to 2 NCAA tournaments in as many years. We're in a whole new world, Dixon said during his long answer. Just go pay money and go get guys. That's what it is. Transfers. It's a new world. New world. New world indeed, but it's not like Iowa State was the only team with transfer starters, 3 Saturday. All of TCU starters Saturday began their careers elsewhere. Emmanuel Miller transferred to the Horned Frogs from Texas A&M. Avery Anderson started out at Oklahoma State. Trey Tennyson had stops at Central Connecticut and Texas A&M Corpus Christi before enrolling at TCU. Ernest Uday played as a freshman at Kansas. Micah Peavy transferred from Texas Tech. Anyhow, during his curious comment, Dixon praised Otzelberger, too, and his point guard, Taman Lipsey, a true Cyclone who prepped at Ames High School. He's a heck of a coach in a place that's hard for opponents to play, with all kinds of resources and fans, he said. They've got highly rated recruits. It helped that the guy, Lipsey, lives down the street. That helps. He's a heck of a player, really good. I'll give him credit for that, I guess. He's a heck of a coach. They've got really good players, but we're in a whole new world now. We've got transfers. It's not like you develop a guy. Keishon Gilbert has killed us twice. He killed us last game. Really good player from UNLV, and now he's here. That's not what was going on back in the day. All of us have transfers. Different world. Reload. You've got to be ready. This league is good. Again, Dixon was answering a question about Iowa State's immediate turnaround from 2-22 one season to consecutive NCAA tournaments and now in the conference title conversation at the midway point of Otzelberger's third season. I hit up the Register's Iowa State text group for the first time in a while, asking for their thoughts on a team that's 7-3 in the Big 12 and 18-5 overall heading into Tuesday's game at 4-6 and 15-18 Cincinnati. Here's the text question. What does Iowa State need to do to keep the mojo going? Peterson answers, continued being the most physical and best defensive team on the floor. That's where it starts, and that's especially important Tuesday night. Cincinnati is second in the Big 12 in rebounds against conference opponents, which means it's critical that the Cyclones, all of them, bring their A games. At Iowa State, rebounding is a team thing. Lipsey, for example, averages 5 rebounds a game, and Gilbert averages 4 6.7. That's almost 10 rebounds a game from the Cyclones' primary ball handlers. Furthermore, Iowa State's defense, the best in many years at the school, can't have a letdown. It must show who's the boss from the game's first possession. 7 games in a row, opponents have had empty possessions on their first attempt at the hoop. An air ball, Lipsy steals in 2 games, Rob Jones blocking Hunter Dixon's shot against Kansas, Rob Jones steal, Curtis Jones a steal and a missed shot. As TCU's Dixon said after Saturday's game at Hilton Coliseum, quote, "They knocked us all over the place," end quote. Next text, what about Iowa State starting on NCAA tournament run in Omaha? Answer is, what about just making it through the day? There's lots that can and will happen before Selection Sunday on March 17. The text group member was referring to preferential seeding that sometimes goes along with being a top 4 seed. And by the way, the first top 16 reveal is at 11:30 a.m. on February 17. It's where the committee has the teams ranked at the time of the reveal. That list will undoubtedly change before the official field of 68 is released. In Iowa State's case, yes, there's a first and second round site in Omaha. The team and its fans certainly would benefit from being placed there. Wisconsin and Marquette could be in contention for the few preferred Omaha regional assignments as well. Here's a text that says, one of the top 4 of the 5 Big 12 title contenders, who has the toughest and easiest remaining schedules? Answer, good question, assuming the current 4 or 5 title contenders are still contenders at the end. First, here are the conference records as of Monday morning. Houston, 8-3. Iowa State, 7-3. Kansas, 7-4. Baylor, 6-4. Texas Tech, 6-4. Oklahoma, 6-4. BYU, 5-5. TCU, 5-5. Texas, 5-6. Kansas State, 5-6. Cincinnati, 4-6. UCF, 4-6. West Virginia, 3-7. And Oklahoma State, 2-9. Here are the top 5 teams' remaining schedules. Houston versus Texas versus Iowa State at Baylor versus Cincinnati at Oklahoma at UCF versus Kansas. Iowa State at Cincinnati versus Texas Tech, at Houston versus West Virginia versus Oklahoma at UCF, and versus BYU at Kansas State. Kansas at Texas Tech, at Oklahoma versus Texas versus BYU, at Baylor versus Kansas State, at Houston. Baylor versus Oklahoma at West Virginia, at BYU versus Houston. TCU versus Kansas versus Texas at Texas Tech. Texas Tech versus Kansas at Iowa State versus TCU at UCF and versus Texas at West Virginia at Oklahoma State versus Baylor. According to TeamRankings.com, Kansas has the toughest remaining schedule in the nation. Rounding out the top 10 are Oklahoma, Houston, Baylor, Texas, Marquette, Iowa State, Iowa, Connecticut, and Michigan. If the Cyclones can hold home court, the bumps in the road come at Houston and KC. They will be fine. That is the text. And the answer is, under the scenario, we've got Iowa State going 13-5 in the Big 12 and 24-7 overall. That'll likely mean a first-round assignment in Omaha and a number 1 or 2 seed in Thursday's March 14 quarterfinal round in the Big 12 tournament. Remember, 14 teams in the conference this season. Top 4 received byes to the quarterfinals. And let's not forget what Kansas State coach Jerome Tang said after losing in Ames. There are going to be teams in our league that will have higher seeds in the NCAA tournament than they do in the Big 12 tournament. On this topic, he's probably right. And the final text says, Gilbert and Curtis Jones are playing better than they played during the non-con season. Their contributions are big reasons for success. Peterson's answer, you're spot on. Gilbert is averaging 16.1 points over the last 7 games, during which the Cyclones have gone 5-2. Jones is averaging 14.7, while the Cyclones have won 5 of the past 6 games. Their contributions have been very significant, but let's not forget Hasen Ward, Damarian Watson, and Jackson Pavlicek. They've had major moments too.
I'll finish up sports by letting you know about a few things you might be interested in watching on television. Tonight on TV, we have some men's college basketball games. At 6 p.m., there is North Carolina at Syracuse on ESPN. And on ESPN2, you can catch Iowa State at Cincinnati. That's men's college basketball. At 7:30 p.m. on FS1, at 7:30 on FS1 is Georgetown at Creighton, if you're interested in watching that men's basketball game. And then at 8 p.m. on ESPN2, Oklahoma will play at Baylor. And at that same time, 8 p.m. on Peacock, Ohio State men's basketball will be at Wisconsin. In women's college basketball, there is a game tonight that you might be interested in watching at 6 p.m. That's going to be shown on BTN, and that's women's basketball, Minnesota at Rutgers. And with that, I think we will turn to Dear Abby. The headline of the column today, Cash Gift from In-Law Wounds Husband's Pride. The first letter says, Dear Abby, my sister-in-law on my wife's side stayed a week and a half with us in Florida. I love her very much, and we all had a lovely visit. She has stayed with us before, alone and with my brother-in-law. We welcome them with open arms. Family means a lot to us. Now to the problem. After she left, I found an envelope with a thank you card and $200 in it. I feel insulted, as they are always welcome here. We are not a B&B. This is the first time something like this has happened. We have a nice home, but my wife was complaining about money issues in front of our company. We are going through a rough patch at the moment, but we are not broke or destitute. Compared to us, my in-laws are wealthy. My ego is bruised. We are better off than most people and are blessed with all we do have. I want to send the money back with a gracious thank you note, but my wife says no. I am angry with her as well. She was out of line for not keeping our money situation private. Was she out of line for not keeping our money situation private? Signed, Fuming in Florida. Abby says, Dear Fuming, please don't be angry about the gift, which was given with love. Write the sister-in-law a gracious thank you note, keep the money, and tell her she doesn't need to give you more because your situation isn't dire. I don't think your wife was out of line. I think she was simply chatting with her sister when she made the remark. And then there is another letter to the readers from Abby. It says, Dear readers, on December 6th, I published a letter from Lost in Louisiana, whose daughter's fiancé canceled their wedding 3 days prior to the event, in quotes, because she's bisexual, end quote. The parent was worried about her daughter's new choices in female partners and upset that she had lied and requested her daughter not bring these women around. After responding to the letter, I heard from members of the LGBTQ+ community, in particular, bisexual people, saying that I, quote, could have done better, end quote, with my response. I have since learned that the bisexual community is the largest segment of the LGBTQ+ community, the least visible, and the most misunderstood. This has contributed to perpetuating the myth that bisexuality is a halfway point between straight and gay, a, quote, stepping stone to people coming out as lesbian or gay, or an identity people claim in order to deny being lesbian or gay. And then Abby says in caps, not true. Being bisexual simply means that the person has the capacity to be attracted to people of different genders. And because one is bisexual does not mean they cannot be monogamous. I regret that I didn't point out to the parents that their unsupportive response may be a reason their daughter had not come out to them as bisexual earlier. Further, I could have suggested that to become a safe, loving, and affirming presence for their daughter, they educate themselves about bisexuality. If they do, their daughter may be more open to hearing their concerns about her choices in partners, which is less about the gender of those partners and more about their treatment of their daughter. Love, Abby. Well, that brings us to the close of the Des Moines Register for today, Tuesday, February 13th, 2024. I'm Dale Finnegan, and my partner at the microphone has been Doug Kretzinger. Earlier, you heard Deanna Snyder and Pat Steele. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.